We discussed or briefly talked about one writer whose works became very, very influential, namely Franz Kafka's works. This, however, in the field of fiction, novel, the short story. And I think today we'll look at another author whose works I think became equally important and influential, this time in the field of the drama, namely Bertolt Brecht.
There are two versions, actually, how to spell his first name. This is the one he himself liked. It was changed from Bertolt, which means lovely, nice, or something like that, and he didn't like that. He thought it was lovely, nice, and sweet. So he changed the name and spelled it in this way.
Brecht, as it is pronounced here, I think, most of the time, because the CH is so hard to pronounce. He was born in 1898, and interestingly enough, he was born in Augsburg, South Germany, as the son of a rich, well-to-do owner of a paper mill. However, already very soon, when he was a high school kid, he revolted against this whole atmosphere which was surrounding him. The first clash came actually when he was supposed to write a high school paper, which at that time every German high school kid had to write on, namely on a quote from a classical author, that it is sweet and pleasant to die for one's fatherland. And everybody, of course, had to say, well, how pleasing and how nice and how good it was to serve one's fatherland, and so on and so on. And Brecht just wrote the opposite, and it was rather stupid to die, especially in a war. And he almost got expelled from school, but by some way or other he made it and finally got out of school. But this rebellion went on and on and on and on. As he himself later said in a little, you might call it a poem, he said, I grew up as the son of well-to-do people. My parents put a collar around my neck and taught me the habit of being waited on and the art of giving orders. But when I had grown up and looked around me, I did not like the people of my own class. And I left my own class and joined the common people. He did not quite do that, not directly. He went to Munich from Augsburg and became a medical student. He started to study medicine. This was in 1916. In 1918, of course, he was drafted, but since he was a medical student, he became a medical orderly in a war hospital and served in this function till the end of the war. When the war had ended in 1918, he returned to Munich, resumed his studies, but he didn't go to the lectures too frequently. He joined, especially in this tumultuous, in these weeks after the war, he joined the Communist Party. Or at least he favored them. Nobody knows for sure whether he actually became a registered member of this party. He himself said no, but this was much, much later, and this was in America when he had to answer to this nasty question. Others say he did join it. So there is no certainty about it. At least he favored the Communist Party, or whatever these little groups that were running all over Germany and shouting were like. He started immediately after this, in 1918, he started writing plays, satires, mostly on the war, satires against the bourgeois world, satires against any kind of exploitation. The early plays are called, one of them is Baal, B-A-A-L, and a later one, Drums in the Night, which actually was the foundation, or should become the foundation for his fame. Interestingly enough, these plays are anything but pleasing or pleasant. They are full of little ballads, which he called legends, which contain sort of the gist of what he wants to say in these plays. Let me read just an excerpt from one of these satirical plays. This excerpt is from The Legend of the Dead Soldier. There's a soldier who is dead, actually. It's a song about a dead body, which is dug up again and solemnly pronounced fit for military service because the emperor needed more soldiers. So Brecht says, please excuse the coarse language, They poured some brandy down his throat, the rotten corpse to rouse. Two hefty nurses grabbed his arms and his half-naked spouse. Because the rotten body stank, a parson limped ahead, and over him his incense swung to cover the stench of the dead. Then it goes on and on and on. And finally it says, the band in the van with rum-tum-tum played him a rousing march. The soldier, as he had been drilled, kicked his legs high from his arse. You could not see him from the crowd thronging round him with hurrahs. One might have seen him from on high, but nothing was there but the stars. So these early plays and these early ballads or poems, as you might call them, primarily revolt against the bourgeois society which surrounded him. They are primarily satires, as I said, on war, on the exploitation of the poor. Interesting is that he took up a tradition which was almost forgotten in Germany, namely the folk ballad. He was often, could often be seen in taverns similar to maybe, what's it called, Greenwich Village in New York, where he sang, well, he couldn't call that sing because he had a very, very poor voice, but that's what he liked. He liked his own poor voice and his own own guitar playing, which wasn't good either. But he thought that just this would make a much greater impression than the smoother, more refined kind of singing. Anyhow, these violent attacks against the bourgeois society gained him fame. He stopped being a medical student and became a kind of a, yeah, in German it's called a Dramaturg at the Munich Theater. This, I think, doesn't, the word Dramaturg or this job doesn't exist here. It's a kind of a play adapter at a theater, at the same time the one who writes the plays and helps to edit them, to produce them. So he had the opportunity to bring his own plays on the stage, and he had the opportunity to use theater in the way he liked it. So for instance, one of the first performances of Drums in the Night, there were big, big posters all over the theater saying, every man feels best in his own skin. Or another one, don't stare so romantically. And the people just looked at it, it's impossible. The lights went off and stage hands came on the stage, still working on the screens. And everybody knew there were screens. They were so poorly done intentionally, so that everybody in the audience should realize these were nothing but screens. Or right before the performance, the producer would come and talk a scene over with the actors. They all came there and smoked a cigarette and said, well, I didn't like your the rehearsal last night. What could we do about it? And then they started rehearsing that a little bit, and stagehands were working and hammering and sawing along, setting up the screens. All this obviously to destroy the illusion of the theater. This is the main aim of the young Brecht in the theater, to destroy the illusion that you're sitting in a theater, that you're watching something that actually has not much to do with yourself, that you sit there, have a good time for 2 hours, and then go home pleased or maybe purified by what you saw. Brecht just intentionally destroyed this kind of theater, which he thought was only for the rich, for the bourgeois, for those who had enough to eat. He, on the other hand, wanted to address the poor, the ones who could not understand a classical drama, could not understand Shakespeare easily. So this is why he had a completely different kind of theater. Strangely enough, this kind of theater and these kinds of plays he was producing gained him more and more fame. One should expect, actually, that all the theater producers would be against this new kind of theater, but they were not. In 1924, he was called by Max Reinhardt, at that time about the greatest theater expert in Berlin, and was called to the Deutsche Theater in Berlin. He again produced the early plays, Drums in the Night above all, the one with the posters, Don't Stare So Romantically. But the success was rather moderate. So he tried something else, and I think one kind of a play which he called an opera, which he became really successful. Again, he did not use music in order to have something pleasing, something mollifying, something sweet. He didn't even like the word music. That's why he re-spelled it Misuk, We're just changing the two vowels, indicating that this was something new, something original, had nothing to do. He admitted, actually, that he hated Beethoven, and that he especially hated symphony orchestras, where all these men, solemn, gravely, looking in the black coats, they were sitting there and scratching along with the cellos and the violins, and he thought this was something that just wouldn't speak anymore. So he created his kind of mizuk, or music, as you want to call it, again with the aim not to enjoy, not to please the audience. He again, in this form too, went back to the popular ballad, a tradition which had almost been forgotten in Germany, but he took it up from the taverns, from little cabarets which were shown in villages and on country fairs, for instance. He took this tradition up and brought it to this great big stage in Germany, the Berlin stage of Max Reinhardt. He also included jazz, which was new at that time, or unheard of. And so in this period of his life, three so-called operas, he didn't give a better word for it, plays, operas, plays, but lots of ballads, lots of songs in it were produced. He himself did not like the German word Lied, for instance, or especially not the word aria, or something like that. So he took the English word song, because he thought this would much better express what he wanted. These plays, or operas, as you might call them, the first one, A Man's a Man, a story about a war, where he just wants to show that in times of war, or in this society, any man can be replaced by any other man. There's absolutely no individuality. It just doesn't matter who you are, you can be replaced easily. Your whole character can be changed without any difficulty, and nothing, absolutely nothing can be done to prevent this. A similar one, Rise and Fall of the City of Mahagoni, where again the sudden riches of this place changed the characters of man again and again. The most famous of them all, and I'm sure you're familiar with this, is the Three-Penny Opera, written at the same time. It's amazing, though, that there isn't too much original Brecht in it. Actually, he used the English drama by Gay and introduced a few ballads by Villon, and that's about all. He was sued for that because he didn't admit publicly that he had just taken over part from other satire and sometimes complained suffering on part of these poor. He collaborated very intensely at that time with actually two composers. First of all, Kurt Weill. Maybe I'll write it on the board. But I don't know how you pronounce the German name. Weill, and the later collaborated with Hans Eisler. So he did not write all of the music himself. He was primarily concerned with the performance, the way these songs are being sung. If you've just heard once the Mack the Knife or anything, you will realize there's no sweetness. And intentionally, these voices are coarse. Intentionally, the melodies are being destroyed. Or whenever they are sweet and pleasing, then something very unpleasant is being said, and vice versa. So not this harmony, which is usually attempted, the harmony between the word and the music, he just destroys it, distorts it intentionally. The point is, the audience should start thinking, say, well, this is impossible. How can a woman sing like that? How can a man sing like that? And then the audience, start thinking about it. And this is his aim, not to have something sweet and pleasing, something you can relax with. Also at that period, he launched another attack, this time and primarily against the system of capitalism, in his own version of the St. Joan, named a play called St. Joan of the Stockyards, set in Chicago. So a modernized version. He relied very much on Shaw's play in this one. At the same time, he also parodied the Schiller version, 18th century, by taking the high German classical style of writing and having these words spoken by simple Salvation Army girls or by the stockyard people. In 1933, we all know Hitler finally came to power and Brecht was forced to leave the country. He always just made it, and actually from 1933 up to shortly before his death, that is up to 1948, he was fleeing and fleeing and fleeing continually. First, he went to Denmark, where he wrote many of his best plays. Then from Denmark, again, when the German soldiers went north, he fled to Finland. The only reason why he went to Finland, he had heard that it was comparatively easy to get a visa to the United States from Finland. So finally, he got it and went to the United States, but via Russia. So he traveled all the way to through Russia and arrived in California. He tried to get into the American movie industry, but he didn't have too much success. Some of his plays were later on performed in New York, but again, although he had rather influential friends, above all Eric Bentley, he was not so successful as he had hoped he would be. And these ideas, the violent attack against capitalism and his obvious relying on communist Marxist ideas didn't make him too many friends in America. But anyhow, in these years, mostly spent in California, he completed the best of his plays. One of them, an attack on Hitler, the Lucullus. Another one, the Galileo, based on the Galileo story. Then a play which I think is about the best he wrote, The Good Woman of Szechuan, as the title is. I don't know, actually a more accurate translation would be The Good Human Being of Szechuan. She just happens to be a woman, but this is not so important. Maybe we look at this play for 2 minutes. We have this a problem which again and again we find in Brecht, the problem of how can you be good, nothing else, how can you be good in this world? So three funny caricatures of gods come down to the earth and look for a good man, a good human being. And they finally find a woman and they give her some money so that she has a start, and with this money she acquires a tobacco shop. Now she tries to be good. This means everybody comes to her shop and says, well, I want to smoke, I don't have any money, I'm too poor, give me some cigars or give me a little bit of tobacco or some cigarettes, I pay you later. And of course she never gets paid. This goes on and on and on, and the tobacco shop, of course, is almost being bankrupt. Then suddenly her cousin comes by the name of Shuita, who actually is the same person, and he's just the opposite. He is smart, or let's say just a good businessman. So he forces all these people to pay their debts, everything, he gets that money, buys more tobacco, and the tobacco shop goes up again. And then again, the good woman, the good human being, Shinte, comes and tries to be good, and this goes on and on and on. Here we do not have any longer these very simple messages, capitalism is bad, communism is good, but in these plays I think the messages are a little more complex, and to us nowadays I think for this reason they are much more convincing. You don't have nothing but didactic and easy solutions, but you have a more convincing, because more complex solutions. Similar, I don't want to dwell on plays too long right now. Let's just mention another one, Caucasian Chalk Circle, or Mother Courage, a story this time based on the 30 Years' War, where again you don't have a clear message, black and white. You have this poor Mother Courage who's in the 30 Years' War, having a little cart, and she's selling all sorts of goods to the soldiers. And there's only one thing she hates, and this is the idea that the war could stop one of these days. She loves the war because war is the basis for her business. She loses all her children in the war. And finally, she has to pull this cart alone. But the point is, she hasn't understood a thing at the end. She remains as stupid as she was in the beginning. She's again waiting for war. War, war, because war is business. So you can't say that Brecht is just attacking war here. attacking the rich, would just create wars in order so that the poor have to suffer. No. Well, finally, although he had written quite a lot, he was summoned to the before the Committee on Un-American Activities. That correct? When somebody is a communist or something like this. And this actually is a marvelous thing that happened to him. Brecht's English was lousy, much worse than mine. But he pretended that it was even lousier than it really was. This means they asked him a question and he had it repeated. You see, so the reason was he could think a little more. And then just he made fun of these persons on this committee. I think you can buy it on a record now. What happened to Brecht there? And of course they said, well, did you ever enter the Communist Party? And he said, no, I never did. Or they said, well, here, this is definitely a communist idea. But did you write that? And they showed him an English translation. He said, no, certainly you didn't. I didn't. Because he said, this is an English translation, which is rotten. I wrote something completely different in German. And so on. So he just was very, very clever in avoiding all these tricky questions, and as I said, especially by his pretending not to know English. He could understand English all right, but just this gave him more time to think, and they actually couldn't prove a thing. And we know that about at least 60-70% of what he said there is nothing but plain lies. But anyhow, he made it. I just heard it on the record, and it's delightful. An American record, not a German one.
Where did you get that record?
I think it's Columbia record.
Was it called?
I couldn't tell you right now. There are other excerpts of Brecht in it.
It's a record about Brecht.
Yes. Yes, I couldn't tell you the exact title. Does anybody else know, any chance? That's just fantastic. Usually he was known to speak very fast, you see, and answer correctly, and just this boom, boom, and there he was, well, and they just, I don't know what the reputation of this committee is. Are they pretty rough or try to be pretty rough?
It's sort of a joke.
Uh-huh. I don't know. But just according to their techniques, I don't know whether they...
They averaged a lot of people in the country.
Oh, did they?
Yeah, but yes, they're pretty good. Like, artists might go to movies with them. They didn't work for 10 years after they called them. They just nominated that. They did do a lot of damage. Probably not so much laughable. But they're laughable, I
think. Yes. Good, but anyhow, Brecht laughed too, and he made it. And they actually, as I said, they never discovered how much he had lied, actually. It was good, and he sure did. But anyhow, after a few years, he realized that he had been summoned to this committee, and this did some damage just from the fact that he had to go there. So he had to suffer a little bit. And finally, he himself said, when they accused me of wanting to steal the Empire State Building, I thought it was high time for me to leave. And finally, in 1948, he left America and went to Zurich, Switzerland, where he worked at the theater. But then the East Germans offered him a theater all for his own, where he could do whatever he wanted to, and he took this opportunity in East Berlin. Now, of course, there were big speeches and TV cameras and microphones, and everybody was there, all the high party officials with nice stars, you know, and said, ha ha, Brecht is our man, finally he came back, and this is where he belongs to, and so on. And everybody, I know we too in the West, we expected a big, big speech, and it was dinner. And so finally Brecht rose and just got up, went down to the great party officials, shook their hands solemnly, and sat down again, continued eating. Didn't say a word. Just marvelous. We think it's marvelous in the West, I think. What he did during these last years, he died in 1956, what he did was primarily theater work. He worked with this group in the Berlin theater, which is called either the Berlin Ensemble, or however you pronounce it, or the Theater am Schiffbauer Damm. Schiffbauer just means the shipbuilder's dam, because Berlin is primarily built in the swamps, and they have lots of dams there, so there's one theater in the street. So this is the same. And this theater crew actually is still about the best in all Germany. It's still up to this day, because there are still people living who work with him and know how to act, how to play according to his way. And in America, I think you have this opportunity to see and listen to Lotte Lenya. I think she travels all over the country. So whenever you... Yes. No, I think she's all over. And didn't you tell me she was also in Minneapolis, and I saw and heard in Chicago. Although she isn't in her 60s, I think, now. But she still looks like a 20-year-old girl. It's fantastic. So this actually was the last thing Brecht did, just bring this theater up to his ideas and really work, and he left his imprint on this theater group. Now, if we look at Brecht the figure, what is Brecht today? What does he have to tell us? There are, I think, primarily two problems that are always in the papers and in all discussions. Namely, the first one, is Brecht a communist or isn't he? As we said, lots of people claim that he entered the party, that he really became a registered member in the 1930s, but Brecht said no. But this was in Washington, of course, in this committee on American activities. And so we don't know. He lied so much. So we don't know. And they obviously weren't sure whether he really joined the party or he didn't. At least he said no. We see that there is this revolt against the bourgeois world and the exploitation of the poor, especially when they were used as cannon fodder. But definitely, we have, on the other hand, Marxist ideas. All over his plays, again and again, we see these Marxist ideas. But from another point of view, you can say he's a moralist rather than a communist. He sort of holds up a mirror to society and says, well, these are your vices. This is what's wrong. And this has nothing to do with capitalist or communist. It's a little wider. At least that's what people in the West think. He's against vices of any kind, and not against vices of Western cultures only. This has been tried to be proved by the fact that those plays, which are most clearly communist, are never performed in the East. Because they again think there's this kind of communism he is presenting there is not 100% according to the party doctrine. They don't like that. In other words, plays which are never performed in the West because we think it's just a doctrinal play, they are also never performed in the East because they think it's not enough communist. It's not outspoken enough. And in the West at least, well, these plays are, for instance, The Mother, based on the Gorky theme, and then The Measures Taken. Another fact which in the West is always considered to be a proof of his opposition to communism is his attitude on the 17th of June 1953. This is in Germany, it's a big day. This is when in East Germany, the workers revolted against the Communist Party and against their, this tremendous amount of work they had to do in order to fulfill this plan and that plan and so on. There was a big, big revolt in Germany on the 17th of June, and which was finally suppressed by Russian tanks. Now the 17th of June is still a sort of a national holiday, in the West, of course, not in the East. And Brecht's attitude toward this workers' uprising against the East German officials was in favor of the workers, against the East German government. He attacked the government and obviously very clearly favored the workers. But on the other hand, shortly before his death, he still maintained that East Germany was the peace-loving country and not West Germany. So up to this very day, there is no definite answer. Is he a communist or isn't he a communist? And I would say he's rather a moralist than a communist, or a Marxist rather than a communist, if you want to have this distinction. More significant, I think, is his renewal of the theater. And this is again and again discussed, I think. I don't know about this country, maybe you know more about this. Does he exert an influence on theatrical theory here or not? At least it's in West Europe, and I think also in the East, he is just the authority for any kind of renewal in the theater. Yes. Yeah, and he did not only write these plays according to his ideas, but he also wrote theory, which is discussed again and again. Well, in order to present theater in a new way. He had, first of all, to create a new language. And then again, Brecht, the communist, was asked, what is your main source for having a different kind of language, a language that everybody can understand, especially the common people? And he said, well, my source is Luther's Bible. Strange for a communist. On the one hand, there are definite influences of Luther's Bible translation in his language. He also took up his native South German dialect. Lots of businessmen's jargon is to be found. And especially on top of this, the street ballad, the ballads sung to guitar accompaniment. Now, when we think of Brecht's ideas to renew the theater, usually we think of some concepts, which are either called the V-effect, I think.
Which is an abbreviation of a lousy German word which nobody can understand, and it's hard to pronounce. It's mainly Verfremdung. Verfremdungseffekt. And usually just this V is taken, and the English people say V-effect, or Verfremdung, roughly speaking, means alienation. Alienation effect, or V-effect.
Realizing that the word alienation is not quite accurate. In French, it's easier to translate, but in English, there's just people either say alienation effect or estrangement effect or something like this. Both words don't quite cover what he meant, and therefore, usually the German V is taken, and people speak of V effect. Well, this is one concept we think of when we think of Brecht and the theater. Another one, non-Aristotelian or Aristotelian theater, or epic theater. Now, what did he mean when he spoke of the V effect, or alienation effect? First of all, this is primarily directed against the old theater of illusion. Usually, or before Brecht, when you went to a theater, let me say, any Shakespeare play or any Greek play, the stage, together with the actors, had to be directed in such a way that the audience should think that they were, let me say, in the Greece of that and that period, in Rome of that period. And the stage had to help, had to give the illusion that although you were here in 1967, you, at that time when you were watching the play, you were watching it as if you were in Rome or in Greece or in any other place or town. Now, Brecht destroyed this. The actor should not, for one thing, he put some emphasis on the actor. The actor should not think that he is King Lear, for instance, or Hamlet, or Othello, but he should alienate himself from him. He should sort of stand beside the literary figure of Hamlet or Macbeth or any other character in order to bring out, in order to communicate the message which King Lear expresses, or Hamlet or Othello. So in other words, he should not try to be 100% of King Lear. This is actually what we think a good actor should do. He should come as close to the figure in the drama as possible. But he said, no, sort of stand beside yourself. Watch yourself when you're acting. You are the actor Charles Smith, and here's King Lear. But don't forget that you are Charlie Smith while you are acting. Don't try to pretend that you are Lear. The point is not Lear, but what Lear has to say and what Lear stands for. So the actor, through his acting, should rather comment on Lear and not be Lear. That's roughly speaking what he says in the theater about this alienation. On the other hand, he uses that word epic theater, which primarily means that the action in the theater should not be presented as going on right now while the audience is sitting in the theater, but should be presented as something that's past, like a story, like a tale. And this is the reason why he used the word epic. I think in this, the word epic is used in a little different way in English. In German, epic covers both epic poetry and all fiction. There is no word for fiction in German. So epic means just a story, a tale, a novel, a short story, and also on top of it, the epic poem. But he was thinking of just a story, something that has happened in the past. and which should not be presented as going on right now, but should be presented by on the stage as something that is past, as a tale, therefore epic. And the actor has to know this story and sort of be free from it in order to portray the point of the story. Now, this destruction of the traditional stage is to create also a distance between the audience and the actor. Again, this attack against the old illusion stage. A distance between the audience and the actors, which enables the audience to look at the action in a detached and more critical spirit. In this way, familiar situations appear in a new light, which again is to create a new understanding of the human situation. In other words, the audience should not just watch, but should be stimulated to think. And this is the reason also why he is using these funny screens and the funny stage settings. He himself compares this new kind of theater to the old one, which he called Aristotelian theater, or dramatic to. Dramatic to Brecht is the old form, the traditional one, the one he wants to do away with. So he says, the spectator of the dramatic theater, this is the old, traditional one, says, yes, I have felt the same. I'm just like this. This is only natural. It will always be like this. This human being suffering moves me because there is no way out for him. This is great art because it bears the mark of the inevitable. I am weeping with those who weep on the stage and laughing with those who laugh. Now, he just turns everything upside down in his idea. On the other hand, he says, the spectator of the epic theater says, I should never have thought so. That is not the way to do it. This is most surprising, hardly credible. This will have to stop. Or this human being suffering moves me because there would have been a way out for him. This is great art because nothing here seems inevitable. I am laughing about those who weep on the stage, weeping about those who laugh. Was that too fast, or shall I read it again? These comparisons. Pardon?
I was just thinking that one of the things when we were studying fraction, I think one of the greatest playwrights in our century, and I think he's allowed to be a musician. You can't act the way he says. Even right. His theater in Berlin did not do this.
Right.
His plays are so great because they're so theatrical, and so he was writing all of his theory for a highly didactic kind of thinking theater, not where we identify with where we critical. And then the great plays, you cannot sit and watch Mother Courage or not. Mm-hmm. You become extremely with Mother Courage and that crazy daughter and people. You know, it was like he was over here with his one hand writing this theory.
Right. Yeah, and this is not only true for his theory of the theater, but also I think for all his ideas.
Yeah.
I think let's look at that for a few moments. We said that according to his theory, the theatrical theory, that familiar situations appear in a new light, and which again is to create a new understanding of the human situation. Now let's just look a few moments at the human situation and the way Brecht sees it. What is this human situation like? For instance, Chanté, this is the good human being, before she becomes her cousin, Chanté, the good human being, says, he who helps the lost is lost himself. For who could long refuse to be wicked when those die who eat no meat? Or shortly later, something must be wrong with your world. She's addressing the gods. Something must be wrong with your world. Why is there a reward for wickedness? Why do the good receive such hard punishment? We can see that actually there is no God in Brecht's world. His world is controlled by evil, by blind, irrational forces. The place of fate is taken by uncontrollable workings of the social order. I mean, if you look at the history of the drama, you always have, at least in the tragedy, you have a representation of fate which varies considerably during the development of the drama. In Brecht, as we say, this place of fate is taken by uncontrollable workings of the social order. Therefore, all these entanglements with Marxist ideas and communism and so on. This social order molds the characters. This tosses them to misfortune or happiness. And man is nothing but a product of the pull of social forces. This, however, is the negative side, as Brecht would have said. He himself insisted, on the other hand, that this was only one half of the picture. On the positive side, he said, was the hope of communism. Sounds nice. But he presents in his plays nothing but the negative side. At the end, sometimes directly or indirectly, it is stated that all this could be changed. He just presents the idea that something actually has to be changed and that it could be changed. But mostly, this is left entirely to the audience. The audience has to decide. He is not able to portray this in his plays. In other words, it is always merely postulated. It is never presented. This hope for change, for the better, is obviously so utopian, I think, that he couldn't show it in the plays. The communist states didn't have any answers. This is quite obvious. Because there also the poor suffered and the rich neglected them. I have a little book here by Martin Esler, one of his biographers, and let me just read one paragraph, how he sees, and I think he sees it very correctly, and this would also come back to your question. He says, Brecht wanted to be a writer for the common people, as easy to understand as fairground comedians, but the simpler he tried to be, the more complex his work became, so that only intellectuals could appreciate it. He wanted to serve the cause of the revolution, but was regarded with suspicion by its recognized standard bearers, who reviled him as a formalist and banned him as a dangerous defeatist influence. He wanted to arouse the critical faculties of his audience, but only succeeded in moving them to tears. This is what you said. He wanted to make his theater a laboratory of social change, a living proof that the world and mankind could be altered, and had to see it strengthen his public's faith in the enduring virtues of unchanging human nature. He had to witness his villains acclaimed as heroes and his heroes mistaken for villains. He sought to spread the cold light of logical clarity and produced a rich texture of poetic ambiguity. He abhorred the very idea of beauty and created beauty. Yet such is the paradox of the creative process that had he succeeded in his objectives, he would have been merely a flat and boring party hack. He failed and became one of the most puzzling, one of the most hotly debated, but also one of the most important writers of his age. I think this is a very good summary. Thank you very much.